this. One of the challenges that we face in communication is keeping people's attention. Yeah. Now, there's several challenges in attention getting and keeping. One of the challenges is that the average human being can process information at the rate of about 600 to 800 words a minute. The average brain can process information at about 600 to 800 words a minute. Did you get one, Patrick?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. But the normal communication speeds, normal preaching speeds, are between 150 and 200 words a minute. So in other words, people can process, can handle a lot more data and information than we can give them in the amount of time we have communicated. And so what it does is it produces gaps. And what that works out to be is that people take trips. Now you do it too, right? When you're listening to speaking, you take trips. You know, different people go different places, but everybody goes somewhere. And you've seen it. It's a pretty common thing. You've been making eye contact with a particular group, and then you happen to look over, and you see they're still looking at you. Yeah, but you know, they're not really looking at you. They're sort of looking through you. Their eyes have kind of glassed over, and they're in your general direction, but you know they've gone somewhere. They've taken a trip. And this happens all the time. It's even more of a challenge now, I think, because of media and the access to internet. And most people have smartphones, and they're not just taking notes, you know. We know, we're not deceived about that, right? They're tweeting, they're Facebooking, they're checking things out, they're doing all sorts of things. A man wrote a book a number of years ago called 101 Things to Do While Listening to a Sermon. I'm sure there's a lot more now. There's a lot more now with technology, so you'd have to make it a 1,001 Things to Do While Listening to a Sermon. So that becomes a great challenge for us, and getting and keeping people's attention is a great challenge for us. And these techniques are especially helpful for getting and keeping attention. That's one of the primary reasons that we develop them and practice them, is they don't add to the anointing, but they will keep people's attention so that God can get a hold of them with the anointing and His Word. Another thing about these techniques and speaking in general is one of the things that happens in communication is that one of the things that leads to people taking trips and moving in different directions when you're trying to communicate with them is when communication is at the same volume, same tempo, it produces a sort of form of white noise. You know what white noise is? White noise is just droning kinds of sounds. Now, my wife and I have been married 35 years, and for most of those 35 years, we've always had a fan going in our bedroom, so we sleep with a fan. It doesn't matter what the weather is. I mean, it could be 15 below outside, and there's still a fan going in our room. And we use the fan for the white noise. It just drowns out other noise. And that sort of droning sound of the fan lulls us to sleep. For years, when we would travel, we would carry a little portable fan with us in hotels, various things like that. Now, of course, we have fancy apps on our smartphones and our iPads. And I have a fairly robust app that I paid for that has got about 100 different specific sounds, but then a whole keypad where I can mix 6 different sounds and all these different tempos and ranges, and you can craft your own personal white noise. And so I have that app on my iPad, and my iPad sits on my side of the bed, and my wife's iPad sits on her side of the bed. She has her own personalized white noise it runs. Yeah. And I have my own personalized white noise too. On top of that, while we're here in the Philippines, we have a fan going in the room too. Because no, dark. Yeah, dark, yeah. But Lots of droning noise. If there was a fire alarm in our condo, we may be in trouble. but certainly we don't hear all the honking jeepneys out in front of our condo. So
any white noise, anything.
A jeepney is white, white noise? I guess whatever you grow up with. The point is what gets your attention, what would get our attention at night, is not the noise, it's if the noise shut down. Like what wakes us up is if for some reason maybe there's a power shortage and all of a sudden the white noise goes up. Huh? Who made that noise? No, it's the absence of the noise, you see? That's what gets your attention. Now, you might think you're the most dynamic preacher in the world, and maybe you are, but unless we vary all of these techniques, that we're just going to be one more white noise app to lull people to sleep. So as we look at these, a lot of the key to this is just variety. It's just knowing all the tools you have in your tool belt and making sure you use them at the right time. One last thought before we look at the specifics is, in the beginning, when you start to work with these, it's a little awkward and it's a little unnatural. When I first started speaking, preaching regularly 35 years ago, I would, on my notes, you know, those were the days of paper notes, I would write big notes to myself on what to practice in that particular sermon, like practice alternating tempo. And so that would be a constant reminder. And, you know, it's like someone that's learning a skill. Anybody who has a particular skill, art, my background is art, or a music skill, you know that there's a certain amount of skill required to be able to communicate. Art isn't really skill, but without skill, you can't really communicate the message. So musicians, they spend hours working on their scales. That's the skill that they learn so that the anointing, the musical gift, has a channel to flow through. And in the beginning, when you're learning anything, it's a little, it's not very natural. I swim in the mornings, and at the pool today, I noticed that there was a couple, elderly couple, well, my age, I guess that's elderly. They may have been in their 60s, so like really old couple. And they were getting swimming lessons, and you could tell they were like starting at that scratch. And you know, the things, you know, I'm swimming back and forth, and the motions that I've done all my life that I take for granted. I remember there was a time when just coordinating, kicking, breathing, strokes, everything, doing it right, you had to think about everything, and it was a little unnatural. Now you just get in the pool and it just flows naturally. So when you start these, sometimes it's a little awkward, and that, you know, it's just the way it is until you get a skill. But then eventually when you get to the point, you're not even thinking about, do I put a pause here? Should I raise my voice here? Should I lower it? Should I get soft? Should I go quiet? It becomes very intuitive. But you've got the skills developed. It's like the basketball drills you do in practice. You've just done them so many times, you know, this is the right time for the pick and roll. It just comes, it's just intuitive, it's just natural, you just know when it happens. But initially, it may not be quite as smooth, but that's okay, we just have to learn and practice. All right, so those are some of my introductory thoughts. We'll talk about pauses first. Pauses hold the audience's attention. Hold the audience's attention. Pauses are one of our best techniques for keeping people's attention. If they've been used to hearing you talk and they've gone on trips or they're having a little discussion with their friends, when you stop, especially if your pause is longer than normal, like there's sort of acceptable pauses, like that that people don't even notice. But occasionally, for effect, when you have a little bit longer pause than normal, guarantee everybody who's been on various different trips, they'll come back to you right away. This Monday, I had the pastor's wives. Y'all should pray for me. That's quite an experience. I'm teaching the Old Testament, too. So I had to get these pastor's wives excited about the book of Amos. Quite a challenge. And it's very difficult because they put them in round tables. Okay, it's just the worst environment to have to preach in. So, first of all, you got these wives. I guess a lot of your wives are there, and I mean, they're just happy to be out of the home, right? They're just glad to have no kids to worry about. They're just happy, and so they're just excited to be with each other. And what's the topic? Oh, whatever, it doesn't matter. We're just together, and they're, you know, and then you put them in a round table. I mean, I tried to fight those women and try to say we can't do that, but you know, they want to do it, so they're the boss. I think we have, I don't know, it's growing, probably 140 or so wives there, and because they're, what's that? Do we, what?
200.
Was that the, is that a real number?
Yes.
You know, it's interesting because one of the Old Testament books was the Song of Songs.
Yeah, no.
Did you? We had a few little awkward moments. So thanks, guys. Well, maybe if your wives were a little bit more romantic that night, then you can thank me.
Thank you.
So they're in these round tables, and because of that, of course, you can't fill that sanctuary. I mean, we got people all the way to the very back, just pushing up against the sound booth, you know? And so trying to control an audience is a challenge. Trying to control an audience of 150 to 200 women who are just happy to be out in a round circle with all their little girlfriends. I mean, just the... And so every time, because I have 36 sessions because we're going through all the Old Testament books, so every time I would finish one and go to another, in every table, chatter would just break out. Like, just because I gave them a moment's little, we've ended one, we're going to another, and all of a sudden, every table, what is this? I don't know what to do with this. So I would start talking, but it wouldn't do it. You know, they just keep chattering. But when I would stop in the middle, and have a really long pause, amazing, I would get their attention back, and then I'd start again. Pauses are really great at holding the audience's attention. Sometimes we have a tendency, if we feel like we're losing our audience, we rush, we speed up, we talk louder. It usually is counterproductive. If we're having a difficult time holding our audience, we probably need more pauses, slow things down. So they hold the audience's attention. Pauses emphasize important words and ideas. Emphasizes important words and ideas. Now, this is something in the beginning you may look at your notes and you may plan strategically in advance. This would be a good time right here to use a pause to emphasize a point that I want to make or some kind of statement that I'm making. This is a good point. But after you've practiced it for a while, intuitively you'll just know this is the time to make sure there's a substantial pause so that what you're saying has the proper emphasis. And it's tied in with number three, pauses add drama. They add drama. I work really hard on illustrations, telling stories. There's an art to telling stories. And I've spent a lot of time over the years watching great storytellers. I even spent a period of time where I watched a channel in the States. I don't know if we have it here, but it's called Comedy Central. So it's a cable channel. And they have a lot of stand-up comics. And of course, not all of them you could watch, but I'd find some stand-up comics that I could watch. And I would watch and try to learn the art of storytelling, because there really is an art to it. It's knowing how to include the right amount of detail. Some people make the mistake, there's just way too much detail, you're lost in the story. Some you don't get enough detail. So finding out what is the crucial detail to really set up the punchline, how do you tell the story, how do you set the story up, how do you give that punchline, it really is an art. But there's a science to it too. So I just studied and I watched these people for a lot of years. And I've been watching good storytellers for years. People who do it intuitively, you know, Pastor Rice Brooks may be the best that I've heard. I don't think he thinks about it. It's just all intuitive to him. But not much comes intuitively for me. I have to actually learn it. So I just watch, listen, see what he did, and then practice it, the science of telling a really good story. And knowing where to pause at the right point in the story to set up the punchline is really crucial to adding the moment of drama. I've told the story for about 30 years in a lot of different sermons, and it's a story that's told by a United States church growth specialist and noted author by the name of Dr. Wynn Arn. And he was producing a movie on church growth, and the title of the movie was Circus. And they were comparing an actual circus and drawing principles from a circus to show church growth. So they went to an actual circus and they were on location for 3 years. The actors that they hired were actually the circus performers. And after 3 weeks of filming, they were all sitting around the set and they happened to be by the trapeze. And they were just talking about some of the things that had happened over the 3 weeks, as you can imagine, this kind of conversation. And a few of the circus performers began to ask Dr. Arn about some of the principles, because mostly it was about risk-taking, which is an important part of church growth. And so they started to ask him, now, what about this risk-taking? Do you do this yourself, or do you just tell other people? Do you just talk the talk, or do you actually walk the walk? It started good-naturedly, but eventually got a little bit of steam, and it eventuated in a formal challenge. I said, here's what we'll do. We're right here by the trapeze. You get up on one side, we'll get one of our performers on the other side. He'll swing the trapeze at the perfect time for you. Swing across, put your money where your mouth is. So he looked at the trapeze, and there's this gigantic net, and it doesn't look that high. So he realizes he's gonna have to follow through. So he says, okay, I'll do it. So they start chatting, and he starts climbing the ladder, 10, 20, 30, 40,000 feet, he said it felt like by the time he got to the top. And an amazing transformation took place during his climb. He said that massive net had shrunk considerably. It didn't look near as big from up there as it did from where he was. He looked across, and there's the circus performing on the other side, ready to throw the swing at the right time. Everybody's down below, shouting, cheering. He took a deep breath and began to swing. He said later, in midair, I learned three things. Now he's paused right there, because in a preaching setting, people are engaged in it. There's always like a laughter. Oh, three things. What three things would you learn? Just hold that pause. In midair, I learned three things. Number one, you've got to let go of some things to grab hold of others. Number two, it's a whole lot easier to keep holding on to the one you got. And number three, which puts it all in perspective, you don't have forever to decide. He reached the apex of his swing. There was the other trapeze. He let go, grabbed hold successfully, and swung to victory on the other side. From at that point, and I usually get a little bit of applause or some relief from the crowd, then it's okay. So thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you. I know you would. Then, of course, we just apply those points to, you know, the message, et cetera. But it's the right pause at the right place to add drama to an already fairly dramatic story. Pauses add drama. Voice quality. A couple things about voice quality. Speak at the appropriate volume for the audience setting and topic. So this is about voice quality, and voice quality is a function of your venue. It's a function of your venue. Now, I have a good friend, Greg Tipton. Some of you probably know Greg. He's our 10 days champion. And Greg, he only has two volumes. Loud and louder, yes. Greg has no indoor voice. It's just always louder, and then he gets even louder. And I've worked with him. We're good friends, best of friends. And so I've tried to help him over the years. He's actually now developing a third level, like normal conversation level. And it's made a significant difference. Because your volume, your whole presentation is based on the venue, the size of the crowd. If you're in a small group, or if you're one-on-one at a coffee shop, your gestures, your use of pauses, all of these techniques, tempo, volume, are greatly subdued in that kind of environment. You get in a little bit bigger environment, maybe a victory weekend, maybe there's 50 to 100. You have to step it up a little bit more. Then you go to another level where maybe a Sunday service and maybe there's 3, 5 or up to 1,000 or more people. According to that venue, now everything has to be exaggerated. Everything has to be exaggerated. Because little gestures like this, that if you're talking to a person one-on-one, have some effect. In a venue like that, are just completely lost and are pointless. So it's not that you become a different person, it's just that you become you amplified based on the environment, the venue that you're in. If you're in a victory group, there's 50 to 100, a victory weekend, 50 to 100, you may move a little bit on stage, but a lot of dramatic movement is probably unnecessary. But you have 1,000 people and you've got to use the whole stage to keep your audience. Just standing behind that podium when you've got 50 may work okay, but when you've got 1,000, it's not going to work. Everything has to be amplified based on the venue and the size of the crowd. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, you've experienced that in practical reality, haven't you? Speak clearly and articulately. Articulately. People have a tendency to slur the end of their words, and you should focus and concentrate on making sure your pronunciation is correct, it's precise, especially for people in your audience who don't have whatever language you're preaching in, if that's not their first language. One of the things that happens to me all the time when I preach in the U.S., because whenever we're in the U.S., there'll always be internationals, especially when we're in a campus environment. We have a lot of international students. And all international students, when English is not their first language, find it difficult to hear, to understand a lot of preachers or to follow them. But they always tell me, because first of all, my pace is generally slower than the average preacher. But also I concentrate on articulation, emphasizing words, making sure I don't slur the end of my words, but they're pronounced correctly and clearly. It aids communication and keeps people focused on what you're doing. And last thought here under voice quality is avoid embolalia. Have you heard of embolalia?
Yeah.
The dreaded disease, EMBOLALIA, embolalia. Embolalia is the use of, hesitation forms and verbal filler, you know, like when you're not sure exactly what you're supposed to say. Now, we have a lot of that in English, but I think there's actually even Filipino embolalia, isn't there? Yeah, I in our staff meetings, I sit next to Nixon, and he's my interpreter. And so sometimes someone will say something, and I said, what was that word? He said, that wasn't actually a word. Just verbal filler. Oh, okay, I understand that. So every language has its own verbal filler. It's just stuff that you fill in when you're not exactly sure what to say. It makes you sound unprofessional. It makes you sound unprofessional. I have waged a 25-plus year battle against embolalia to eradicate it from my communication. I occasionally do it, but when I do it generally, it's strategic. I'm actually doing it for a purpose. Having waged this war, and I haven't completely won the battle, it still slips in. But having waged that war, I've had numerous times when after preaching, professionals, a couple times in Nashville where we had newscasters, people who speak publicly for a living, have talked to me. I'm thinking of one very influential newscaster who talked to me. That was their first time at church, but the thing that impressed them the most about church was that in my entire, well, they called it talk, my entire sermon, I didn't use one bit of verbal filler. That's what impressed them about the church the most. So that was professional, and that got their attention, see? So, well, it was worth it for just that one person, you know, whatever it takes for God to work in their life and impress them and make them want to come back. So this is probably going to take somebody helping you, like an assigned embolalia catcher. You can assign your wife with this responsibility. Every time, yeah, count them up. I do that with my students when we do preaching. We do a preaching exercise in the School of Campus Ministry in the States. And sometimes, to make a point, I will count in a 6-minute sermon how much embolalia. And you can get upwards of 30, 40 different infractions in a very short period of time. Yesterday morning, I was meeting with my small group, and it's 6 or 7 guys who are some of our leaders in the life box. And one of the students was talking about this, because he'd been in the class when I talked about this before, and how he was fighting the battle against embolalia. For him, it was about preparation. The more he was prepared, the more he knew what he was trying to say, the easier it was to avoid embolalia. Or also, what he started doing is, when he got to the point, instead of using filler, he would just use pauses. And so it was actually helping to correct his embolalia, plus it was providing all the benefits that pauses do also. And that's what I do too. When I come to some place and I'm not exactly sure what my next word is, I'll just pause. Now, most people think I'm just really smart, but I've actually lost my train of thought. But I need a second to get it back. And if you don't lose your cool and get nervous, you can get it right back. It's when you kind of, you get a little nervous yourself, and that communicates nervousness to the audience. But when you're just cool, they think he must have planned that. Any thoughts about anything we've talked about so far? Yeah.
Another challenge of a lot of Filipinos is we're not native speakers.
If there's a mic, can we pass it to Jay while he's talking? Keep talking, Jay, but we'll get a mic to you. Yeah.
So primarily, it is not our first language.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, what can we do, or any technique that we can considerably reduce in Vallelia, especially if we are communicating in English?
Now, I think people here should answer that question, because I've been speaking English all my life, so it comes pretty natural to me. And I would hate to be in your situation, because most of your life, you spend most of your time speaking in Filipino, don't you? Tagalog, I mean, when you're at home with your family, most of you, 60, 70, 80%? Is it? Yeah, but I'm talking about generally. Would that be fairly accurate? Exceptions here and there, but generally, most of your communication, yeah. And so that would be I would find that very difficult, because you're doing most of your thinking in Tagalog and then translating, which has to be a slow process. We had this discussion on Tuesday morning with the guys, and I think if I was here, the thing I would ask myself is my calling primarily to the Philippines? If it is, then I would try to become the best Tagalog speaker I could possibly be. I would do everything I could to be good in that language. And then I try to preach as much as I could in that language. And I know we always need more people who can preach in Tagalog, because a lot of people find it more difficult, right, to preach. At least that's been what I've discovered talking to people. So I would try to either be the best at that, or if I thought that I had some kind of international, I was going to be outside the Philippines, then I would do just the opposite. I would try everything I could to focus to make English a much more natural language, speaking it more often, thinking in English, praying in English, reading my Bible, talking to God in English, getting used to doing everything in English, so there's not that translation process that you have to go through in your brain. That's my first thought, but I'd love to just open it up. Yeah, Saul.
Pastor Paul, when you're out of the country and you're preaching English and there's an interpreter,
yeah,
what's the best way to communicate it? Do your pauses, or you just have to...
Yeah. Don't go to those churches.
But we're in 10 days missions, or... What do you do? What can we do?
Good boss.
Yeah. Not a strategic pause. This is a pause because I don't know what to say.
Awkward pause.
For a long time, I had a battle with interpreters. I called them interrupters. It's so hard to get the flow of thought going. And you know, the thing that's even more frustrating is that often in that situation, you have a considerable percentage of people who speak English or understand English fairly well. I had to speak one time in Norway, and everybody in Norway speaks English except those who haven't been educated. So it was a church of about 600, and they had about 10 to 15 people who didn't understand English. Because of that, for that 10 or 15 people, they made me go through an interpreter. Whereas the vast percentage already knew English, but they had to do it for those 10 or 15. I thought it would have been much better have a little section for them and just have someone that's interpreting right there for them. But see, they didn't want to embarrass them. So I had to suffer as a result. And it's awkward because everybody, with just a few exceptions, understand what you said the first time and the second time. So they're critiquing the interpretation. You can't get a flow of thought. It's just a bad situation. But the last time I was in the Ukraine at our Every Nation Church, I decided I was going to make peace with interpreters. And what I discovered I could actually do is, because of that gap, I could actually write my sermon out. I mean, I always do anyway. And so I would actually go into the pulpit now with a prepared manuscript. And so I have thought through all of my breaks in advance. I got it marked out on my notes, on my text that I'm reading. And because I've got a gap in between my last statement and my next, I have a chance to look down at my notes, so I'm not reading my notes. They don't know I'm reading. It looks like I'm communicating, but I've thought through it strategically. I've got the right stop exactly where it went. And in the end, I thought, I can live with this. So that's what I did to make it work. You may find that, I guess very few of you actually write your sermon out, do you? Anybody here do a full manuscript? No, more than I thought. Okay, great. Herwood, sure. Help us.
My other missionaries, colleagues here can also give a comment. I think one technique that you can also apply is you have to talk with your translator prior to the preaching and encourage the person to preach with you. So that will help a lot. But of course, you know, you are at the mercy of how good the translator is.
Not only how good they are in translation, but their spiritual anointing.
Yes. Yeah. So but that's tough. I think that's what one thing that you can probably do. Make sure that you give some time to orient or talk with your translator.
Well, I will especially go through all of my stories. Because often in stories, we have idioms that won't translate, or we have cultural references that won't translate. So I try to think through all of those potential cultural references and let them know in advance. Now I'm going to say this, how does that translate? And so they're ready in advance. So yeah, I'll do all those things too. Yeah, so more thoughts about people who, this dual language situation, the question that Jay brought up. What are some thoughts about that?
When we had a class with Barsha, English class, one of the things that she asked us to do is to listen to our own messages, which is very, very...
Who hates that?
Because she said that if you're aware that you're actually using fillers, it would reduce your fillers to 50%, which actually is very helpful.
It is, yeah. My friend David Houston, some of you know Pastor David, when he was pastoring in Southern California, every week for years, he would listen to his sermon that Sunday, and then his Monday morning staff meeting, his whole staff would have listened to it, and they would critique his sermon every single Monday for years and years. That's a really painful discipline, but it made him a good speaker. It's just painful, right, to hear your own voice? The first thought you have is, I don't sound like that. But, you know, we have the advantage of hearing ourselves through the echo of our own skull, which provides a sort of a mellowing effect. It makes our voice sound a lot softer, mellow, a little nicer. When you hear yourself through amplification or hear yourself on tape, that's what other people are hearing, which is kind of a scary thought, isn't it? There's only one thing I think that is more painful than listening to yourself. It's watching the video. Yeah, that's a cringe factor right there. How many videotape your services? Just a few, okay? Yeah. Watching those videos, that's a humbling experience. But if you want to be great, you ought to do it. And maybe just for a month, you know, just torture yourself for a month. For 1 month, I'm going to ask somebody to videotape, and I'm going to watch him, and I'm going to have some people help me and critique. And I'm going to put myself through that 1 month of hell and see what I can learn from it. I imagine it would, in the end, would be one of the best learning experiences of your ministry life. So, other thoughts? All right, let's talk about tempo then. Tempo, and you know what I mean by tempo, that's speed, right? How fast you talk. Have you seen, communication, writing, research about nonverbal communication. You're familiar with that whole concept that very little or a very small percentage of our meaning is communicated just in the words that we use. And I've seen different statistics, and I'm not exactly sure how they can tell, but certainly a significant percentage of our message is communicated in nonverbal kinds of communication. And those are things, obviously, just beyond pauses and gestures and animation and movement and things like that. But tempo, voice tone, volume, etc. These are communicating significant messages to the people. And so you have to be aware of what tempo communicates to people to know when to use that tool. So we're just going to talk about two basic tempos here. We're going to talk about a fast and a slow tempo. So a fast tempo communicates intensity, energy, and movement. A fast tempo communicates intensity, energy, and movement. A slow tempo communicates solemnity, drama, and importance. Some people think that to keep people's attention, they should talk fast, fast talking. And some people are more natural, they're fast talkers. Now, how would you classify yourself? Would you say that basically, in just normal communication, I'm a fast talker or a slow talker? How many fast talker, generally? Let me see your hand. Just basically, you're a fast talker, okay? Slow talker. Okay. People who are slow talkers, naturally, you're going to have to concentrate more on fast talking when you need it. Fast talkers, you're going to have to concentrate on slow talking when you need it, because there are times you need both. These are two different tools. You got to have both. I remember the first time I heard a friend of mine. He was in our church. This was years ago in Maranatha, and he ended up going into vocational ministry. He's been a missionary for 30 plus years now. His first sermon, he was still a student when he gave the sermon, but he was originally from Chicago, and Chicago people are sort of known for being fast talkers, and they kind of talk out of the side of their mouth, and they big fast talkers, and so he's just a Chicago boy, just pure, simple Chicago. His first sermon was like a runaway freight train. It was the fastest thing I'd ever heard. He spoke for about 40 minutes, but if you wrote a transcript out and then a normal person preached that message, it'd take you 2 hours to do what he did in 40 minutes. And I guess he thought that would keep people really excited. But, you know, it's like the white noise. After a while, without diversity, it's just like, it's just the whirring fan that's just going to lull you to sleep. And you've had the experience of having slow speakers who never seemed to say what they want to say. You're just dying out there. But generally, you say the most important things the slowest. You use a fast tempo when you're trying to create a feeling of excitement, energy, movement. But of course, it only is effective if you've been talking at a normal volume or a normal tempo or then a slow tempo, and then you go into fast pace, you see. If you've been fast the whole time, it doesn't have any effect. Generally, the most important things you say in the slowest. When you want to emphasize a point, you slow down. And that communicates to people, this is something serious, he's saying. It usually goes along with volume. Let's talk about volume, too. Volume, so a loud volume versus a soft volume. Fast tempo, slow tempo, loud volume, soft volume. Loud volume communicates grandeur, authority, power. Usually, fast tempo and loud volume go together. Usually. Usually when you start talking faster, your volume intensifies. Although there might be some times when you're talking fast, but you bring it down and you talk a little slower. But generally, those two are going to go together. And the same thing goes for slow tempo and soft volume. Generally, when you slow things down, your volume also decreases. Now think about this. Raising children, most of you are still raising children. We're finished, thank God. It's good, let me tell you. It's good. And it's worth it all. I'm enjoying it. And you know, growing up or when you're with your children, if I would, one of my children would hear this me say something like this in this tone, this volume. Joseph, get down here right this minute. What does he know automatically? He's in trouble. He knows he's in trouble. I didn't have to say you're in trouble. What said you're in trouble? Yeah, my volume, my tone said you're in trouble. So he knows that's trouble. But there's another tone. When he hears this tone, he knows it's at a new level. And it's like something like this. If you ever do that again, you will die. Now you see, we've taken it up to a new level. You know, that first tone, okay, he may get in trouble, but he may not. You know, he may be able to sweet talk or he may be able to get out. That tone, he knows there's no way out. I can never do that again. So, soft. You usually say the most important thing is the slowest and the softest. Tito.
Pastor Paul, does this apply in all occasions? Because most of the time, myself, I'm pastoral services. No? I don't really preach on Sunday service.
Yeah.
In weddings, in memorial services, no? And all those kind of quality and everything that we're doing can be applied there most of the time.
Yeah, I think that certainly. Yeah, absolutely. Any kind of public speaking venue, especially of a ministry nature. Yeah. Yeah, good question. All right. Let's do gestures and then break. Gestures are the specific motions of the arms, hands, and body made to help express your thoughts. They should be natural and reflective of your personality and subject matter. Are the specific, and you could even say strategic motions, because gestures should be strategic. We're not just flailing our arms. We're not just randomly moving and doing things. There's a method to our madness. And gestures, a couple thoughts about gestures. Gestures should be natural. So if you're a person who uses your hands a lot when you talk, then when you're up in front of people, you should probably do that also. If you're a person who doesn't as much, then you might not. Although you have to remember that there's a big difference between personal one-on-one communication and preaching. When we're preaching, we're doing a monologue. This is not a dialogue. This is an event. And so the kind of rules that regulate small group or interpersonal or one-on-one communication don't apply entirely to preaching. So if you're not normally, if you don't use gestures normally, you're probably going to need to learn how to use them, especially if you want to maintain the attention of a large audience in a large venue. It's pretty essential. But it will be reflective on the venue, right? If you're in a little small group and you start using these very grand sort of gestures, it just looks weird. But, for example, on Monday, when I'm on stage like that, I've got to exaggerate all of my motions. So if I'm trying to communicate something's making me weary, instead of just doing this, I'll just collapse my whole body like that. Now, you wouldn't do that normally if you're just talking to someone one-on-one. But in a venue like that, you've got to exaggerate to communicate what you want to communicate with people. Any thoughts about that? I heard that one, and then JR. Yes, I'll go.
Does facial expression land on gestures as well?
Yeah. Okay. So what do you want to say about facial expressions?
No, because according to our notes, it's just arms, hands, body.
Yeah.
So
stick
I was thinking, you know, it may come with the facial expression.
Facial expression.
Yeah,
important.
All right. So that's about it.
And, you know, that's important, too, because if you have a smaller venue, then most people can see your expressions. If you have a larger venue, it's harder for people in the back, unless it's being videotaped, and so that you're up on the screen. So you have to be aware of that. If you know that your big old gigantic face is going to be up on that screen, then you know you're going to use those gestures. I mean, excuse me, those facial expressions with greater strategic thought in advance. So yeah, great. JR?
Yeah, my experience in theater, we always say that the people in front paid as well as the people at the back paid.
Oh, yeah.
So whatever you're trying to communicate to the people in front, the people at the back must be able to see,
yeah, that's great,
and hear and feel what you're trying to say. That's why it's not only about the bigness of the crowd. It's because when you are far from the audience, even if you say just this, they see it as just this. So you have to somehow exaggerate, because when you are far, they can't see. So it will be more effective for you to really stretch those gestures so that people will see it as if it's just normal.
Yeah. Unless, of course, you're on these massive, gigantic screens twice your life size. So you'll have to take that into account. All right, let's take it. Go ahead, Jerry. Yeah, let's try it. One last thought here.
Yeah, a while ago you mentioned about musicians having their own scaling to practice. What could be a good scaling for all of us? Or rudiments in preaching?
Well, I think all of these, this is like our scales. So these are the things that we practice. You know, you don't learn scales so that you can do scales real well. Like, I practiced for years. I'm the best person at doing scales, man. So you learn scales so that it provides the form that the artistic expression can flow through. So these are our scales. These are and there's plenty more too. These are the things that we learn, that we practice, and we go over and over and over, so that the anointing can flow through. Yeah, great. Okay, let's take a break.